Welcome to the Sunday Times Politics Weekly, where we unpack the big political stories of the week. My name is Mike Siluma, and my guests this week are Umawande Mashabalala, who's the Sunday Times political journalist, as well as the Sunday Times politics editor, Usibonga Konke Wakashoba.
Man, this aircon is racist.
I've never, ever been a spy.
Can the VBS bank loot?
The problem is that pinky.
I'll never subject myself to whiteness.
Order!
I'm listening.
Can you have consistency, Honorable Chair?
Corruption was an Olympic sport. They will always win gold.
This is not a shape.
Sergeant at arms, can you please come
on the
in?
Point of order.
Welcome to the show, folks. In our stories this week, we will be looking at Jacob Zuma's legal troubles following the withdrawal of his lawyers from his corruption trial. We'll also be looking at developments at the State Capture Commission, whose offices were burgled this week. We'll round off by looking at the long-running step-aside issue, which is playing itself out in the ANC. Let's start with you, Mawande. Once more, thanks very much for joining us. What is one to make of the burglary that happened at the State Capture Commission offices?
Thank you very much, Pramay, for inviting me once more. That's a tough question, Pramay. You know, one may end up sounding like a conspiracy theorist on this one, but I guess we must comment anyway. You know, Pramay, of course, the work of the commission is important for the country to move forward from the chaotic so-called Zuma years. And the much as the commission is important to the country, it is very detrimental to a lot of individuals who are seen as those that enabled corruption, state capture, and fraud in government and institutions of government. So, of course, it was never going to be a free ride for the commission, especially for those that stand to lose something from its findings. And we know for a fact now that the commission is going towards wrapping up its work, and which should be issued around June, July, or somewhere there. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, the worries or concerns among those that were the proponents of the so-called state capture project are beginning to rise now that we are reaching towards the end of the commission. And some will be concerned to know what is it that the commission has in its possession to try to predict the findings. Am I going to be implicated? And how am I going to be implicated in the report? And stuff like that. So it is expected that the people who are worried would be the ones most likely to want to know what does the commission has in its possession, and thus try to get in by force to get to see for themselves what is it that the commission has in its possession. I think that is what could have happened, Pramay. But I think as the police investigation unfolds, we'll get to know more about the possible scenarios of what could have happened.
Yeah. And what was the commission's response?
Of course, the commission said, in fact, it was not the only one. The one that was reported this weekend, there was another one before, which was not publicized. So it was the second one. But I think the previous one, the first one, they said, the commission said, was just a bullet hole and a bullet inside the commission offices where it stores its documents and, you know, digital stuff. So the commission said, of course, they opened the case and they are waiting for police to investigate and get to the bottom of the issue, which I think is the most sane way to handle the issue. But of course, the commission chairperson did comment that this, if it is intended to intimidate the commission or derail it, it is not going to achieve anything. And as such, many people had expected that maybe on Monday the commission was going to say, let's hold off, let's postpone, let's, you know, or maybe this week, let's postpone while this issue is being under investigation. But as far as the operations of the commissions are concerned, the attempted burglary or the burglary didn't derail the commission at all, as the commission has been continuing at an even much higher pace, such that this week we've had 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. sessions since Monday, and today up to Friday it will be the same thing. So it seems whatever, if the intention of the burglars or their handlers was to derail or intimidate the commission, it didn't achieve anything. If anything, it motivated the commission to be much more hardworking in its fact-finding mission, Brahma.
Yeah, I was very surprised, you know, because it didn't seem like whoever did the burglary, that they were wanting to take a lot of things, you know. I mean, it looks like, you know, a couple of laptops, that's all they took, you know, more or less.
As I was saying, of course, it would be a specific individual or individuals who are only interested in information that relates to them or that relates to people that implicated them or that are going to implicate
them.
So they wouldn't be wanting to take everything. And maybe when you take a laptop or a computer, you're hoping that you will get hackers to hack in and get to the file that you are interested in, and maybe with the hope that it only exists digitally, and thus by destroying it, you are derailing the commission that is about to close, such that if the commission doesn't have that work in any other way but digitally, it may find itself not concluding that piece of a testimony or evidence that relates to you, the party that is being implicated.
Oh, okay. And then, you know, just very quickly, who are the kind of interesting characters who are likely to be coming before the commission in the next week or so?
Well, of course, the interesting character that is coming next week is the president of the country, President Cyril Ramaphosa, in his very first appearance to the commission. There's a lot that has been said about him. You would remember the issues of Brian Molefe and Eskom, also Machira Kok and Eskom, you know, trying to place President Ramaphosa in the crime scene, and just generally his role as a member of government during that time and what his government has done so far in trying to avoid what happened in the previous administration. So I think there's a lot of interest in that particular testimony of President Cyril Ramaphosa. But for me, the most important witness that among the remaining ones as the commission is wrapping up its work is Mr. Arthur Fraser, the former Director General of the State Security Agency. There's a lot of things that have been said about him and how he participated in all sorts of rogue intelligence gathering and weaponization, politicization of the State Security Agency during his time as a Director General. And in fact, as early as this week, he was once again implicated in how he was involved in setting up counter-vetting, or in fact, rogue vetting, such that if you were vetted, but you are an enemy of whichever faction that he was working for, they would do other re-vetting. The case of Mgodisi Mncwasana was mentioned on how they embarked on re-vetting him after he was issued with a top secret vetting certificate, you know, security clearance certificate, and also how the same was done to the IGI, Dr. Isaac Bindwe, and how same re-vetting rogue processes were employed as well in blocking Mr. Robert McBride in getting another term as the IP head. So for me, it is very, very important, because much of the work of state capture wouldn't have been a success if a state security agency didn't go rogue and try to do work that was underhanded to intimidate or to implicate falsely those that were opposed to the state capture project. So for me, if the commission finishes without Arthur Fraser being made to account, I think that a significant part of the state capture project will be left hanging and not understood. And it is well possible that he may not testify, because there are issues of documents that he has asked for, which are classified, that he said he has asked for them to be declassified before he testifies. But what was interesting last week, the head of the legal team, Mr. Paul Pretorius, said Mr. Fraser, in any case, has important information that should be beneficial to the commission, and that he must testify in any case, even in the absence of those classified documents. Because I also feel that he uses the classified documents as an excuse, perhaps to avoid accountability, by saying he will only testify if those documents are declassified, because they will enable him to testify fully and give a proper complete picture. So that's, for me, that's one witness that I think should, by all means necessary, testify before the commission closes.
Mm. So from what you're saying, it may very well be that he ends up being subpoenaed to appear.
It looks like that may well be the case, because but there was a glimpse of hope last week when his lawyers appeared on the issue of the declassification of the documents, in that it seemed that there was no longer a legal battle between him and state security agency. And it seems like they have been handling it in a brotherly manner of saying they will declassify. Of course, there will be maybe reduction of certain information that cannot be revealed in those declassified documents. So I really hope that process gets completed quite soon, such that there is no need for him to be subpoenaed. But even if that is the case, I think there will be a need for him to be subpoenaed, so that at least the role of the state security agency will be complete and the full picture will be understood through his testimony, Brahman.
Okay. And before I let you go, Mawande, you said that the commission is expected to finish its work June, July. Does that mean all evidence heard and the Deputy Chief Justice's report done? Or is it just the hearings that are supposed to be finishing around July?
No. That is the completion of the whole work. Remember, Frank, I said previously that when the commission, in its latest approach to the court for an extension, it was supposed to have completed its work in March, including the report. But when it saw that that was impossible, they approached the court and asked for a 3-month extension. And in that court application, they had argued that they will wrap up the oral hearings in end of March, April, and then use 2.5 to 3 months to compile the report and have it ready by end of June, early July. But of course, already there's a delay in that oral hearings that were supposed to have been put to bed are still continuing. And as I said before, they will spill over to May, which presents a bit of a challenge there about whether the commission will have enough time to finish its compilation of the report, or it will have to approach the court once again to have another extension, which presents challenges of financial implications. But the June for now is the standing deadline to complete all work, hearings, and the report combined.
Okay. Mawande Mashabalala, we'd like to thank you very much for joining us on the Politics Weekly. We hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much, Pramak.
Let's now go to another issue of the week that relates, of course, to the man who is supposed to be at the center of the State Capture Commission, but yet he is not there. The former president, Jacob Zuma. Sibongiseni, it looks like the former president is having legal problems that are mounting by the day?
Yes, Pramak. So this week it emerged that his attorneys, Mabuza attorneys, the lawyer Eric Mabuza, filed a notice of withdrawal in the Pietermaritzburg High Court, saying that they will no longer be representing Mr. Zuma. There is a lot of speculation about the reason, because reasons are not stated in the in the notice itself. So there's a lot of speculation out there why Mabuza and the rest of the team is withdrawing from the Zuma case. You must remember, Pramak, that former President Zuma has been telling us that his current lawyers are representing him pro bono because he has no money. He's been stripped naked. And we heard from the recordings of meetings with the ANC leadership when he tells them that he's got nothing left, can't even afford lawyers. So the current development now confuses us as to what could be behind this. Is it a disagreement around the approach to the case? Or is it because of that judgment last week by the Supreme Court of Appeals, where the courts ruled that President Zuma must pay back the mandate the state has spent for his lawyers since 2006, and that the state cannot pay for his legal fees going forward. And they're saying that the decision to grant him such a benefit was unlawful, unconstitutional, and invalid. And yeah, so it makes you wonder whether they were banking on that ruling so that they could be paid for representing President Zuma, or they had a fallout with President Zuma about the approach of the case going forward.
So the cynical view also might be that this is going to come as a blessing for Jacob Zuma, that it would enable him to wangle another delay to the case, you know, by saying, look, my legal team has gone. I can't appear by myself. I need to find another legal team that needs to be, you know, to be briefed.
Of course, but Mike, whether this is a blessing in disguise for President Zuma or it's part of his delaying strategy, it remains to be seen. But you are right, you are correct. It presents him with an opportunity to further delay the case, because by the time they appear next month, he will say, I no longer have lawyers. I need to get new lawyers. And it's interesting, Pramak, if he would show up with new lawyers, or he will show up at court and say, I no longer have any legal representation. Can I apply for legal aid? Or will he say he wants to represent himself? So we are all just waiting for that court appearance to see what's going to happen next.
And just as a recap for, you know, because this case has been pending for such a long time, you know, what is it about, you know, just briefly?
So this case is an old case, Pramaki. It relates to the arms deal, but it also relates to kind of relationship that that President Zuma had with his then former financial advisor Shabir Sheikh. And then there was an allegation that President Zuma was actually on the payroll of one of the companies that were doing the bidding and was receiving 500,000 rand per annum. And there was a fax to that effect that had some kind of an agreement to show that there existed such an agreement. And there was also payments from Sheikh to President Zuma, which included all types of payments that you can imagine, including car wash with 10 rands. So it's a very old case. So President Zuma applied for state assistance in 2006 initially. When he was first charged, and he had an agreement with the president that they were going to settle his legal bills, and the charges were then withdrawn, and then he applied again in 2008, and then from then on the state kept on paying for his legal fees, and there are different views about how much he owes the state. The DA claims he owes about 15 million rands. The others will say it could be as much as 32 million rands if you go back to all the cases that President Zuma has been represented and had their bills paid by the state.
So if any of these numbers, whether we're looking at 15 million rand or 32 million rand or whatever, then however many the millions are, it means that he could potentially be sitting with both a political problem as well as a financial problem, which would completely ruin him.
Of course, Pramak, he's already dealing with a financial problem. Remember that he's still paying back that 7 million rands that was loaned to him by the VPS Mutual Bank after the public protector found that he had benefited from the upgrades at his homestead in Tandla. So now this is in addition to that. Now he has to settle let's say a 15 million rands bill, and then politically is against the ropes. His faction is against the ropes within the ANC. He is a man who's really in trouble these days.
And with him being out of power, presumably there are not too many benefactors, you know, hanging around or coming forward to bail him out.
Yeah, a few months ago, there was a story coming from KZN about how influential people, including leaders, were no longer traveling all the way to Nkandla. Someone posted that people were now complaining about their tires, that their tires get worn if they travel such a long distance. Yeah, Bramike, if even with the tea parties, Bramike, that people have been going to Nkandla, going to see him. Well, you had Julius Malema, and then you had Kildama, but you didn't see like the powerful ANC leaders who are still very much influential. None of them made the trip to Nkandla, and even the top six, when they had to meet him, they said, no, let's go to Luthuli House. And he ended up not going there. They ended up having that meeting via Zoom. So he has lost a lot of friends, and I saw today there was a poster going around urging his supporters to donate money for to fight his legal battle. So he is really in the cold right now.
Let's go to the other topic of the week, you know, that again, which has been a long running issue, the step aside issue in the ANC. Why has it become such a prominent issue, you know?
The step aside issue is going to have serious consequences for either of the camps. So President Ramaphosa is believed to be gunning for a second term. These people are saying that he is keen on a second term, and there are people who don't want that. There's a faction in the ANC that feels that President Ramaphosa is too close to business. They feel that under his leadership, there's been a page of black executives, or especially in the private sector. They feel that black business is not benefiting as much as they want it to be. So they are saying he's not implementing resolutions of NASREC. So that group would really fight very hard to make sure that Cyril Ramaphosa doesn't get that second term. And for that group to succeed, Bramike, which is why step aside is such a hot potato, it needs Esma Kgashulu to remain in office. And with this step aside rule, Esma Kgashulu is likely to be one of the the victims of these rules, because he is facing charges. He's been charged formally by the NPA, and the rule says that anyone who is charged must voluntarily step aside. The position of Secretary Pramak is very important in the ANC. It's the engine of the organization. It's the person who runs the organization on a day-to-day basis and takes very crucial decisions that could influence whatever outcome if there is to be an elective conference tomorrow. So if you are fighting against the president, surely you need a secretary general to remain in that office. And that's what Cyril Ramaphosa's backers are banking on. And that is why there's such a pushback to say, no, if you are saying people must step aside, then everyone who's accused of wrongdoing must also step aside.
And in the as you were alluding to earlier on, in the context of the current state of the ANC, if you're saying everyone, it might knock out a whole lot of people. You might have very few people of influence left.
It's very funny, Pramike, because no one would be left there. Because what they are doing is that so Ramaphosa's detractors are saying anyone who has allegations against them, either reported or just allegations flying around. So what happened leading up to that crucial NEC meeting, we saw stories coming out implicating the president to some allegations of corruption. And then you can see that this was a planned leak, so that more and more people then develop that cloud over their heads, so that when you say people who are accused must step aside, it should start from the top. It should start with the president. And then the other people in that top six who have allegations against them, you have got the national chairman, Kgwedema Ntashe, who has allegations against him at the Zondo Commission. You have D.D. Mabuza, a lot of allegations, books written about him. You have Paul Mashatile, a lot of allegations, people throwing at him every now and then. And then you have Esma Kgashulu. So the top six alone, you could end up having no one left there. And it would really collapse the organization. And I don't even want to go through the NEC, because there are a lot of leaders who have allegations against them. So that seems to be the strategy, Bramike, to say everyone must just step aside, so that everything will collapse. And it's a strategy so that maybe those who are pushing for Esma Kgashulu to step aside might just retreat and say, okay, in order for the unity of the organization, no one must step aside. Let's continue and wait for the court processes.
Okay. And the controversy has now reached all the way down to parliament, affecting the chief whip of the ANC.
Yes. Yeah, that's a very interesting story, Bramaik. So our colleague Andisiwe Makinana wrote a story last week about how the son of the ANC chief whip, Pema Jordina, his name is Umkhonto Wesizwe, actually benefited from a PPE contract that was issued by the ANC caucus. Yeah, with everything that has happened, you don't expect a chief whip of the ANC to do something so clumsy. With the PPE scandals in Gauteng and elsewhere, having been in the news, people having been removed from their positions, people being suspended, you don't expect the chief whip of the ruling party to grant a contract, such a contract to her son. She did it. She gave her son a contract to purchase just more than 100 thermometers worth 52,000 rands. And initially, when he went to her office, Pramike, they were saying, no, actually, we don't need to go out to tender if it's less than 100,000 rand. It was an emergency purchase. And you ask yourself, it's an emergency purchase. Why look inside your house? Why don't find someone else who's a business person operating?
Yeah, who's not obviously conflicted.
Exactly. But now with this story coming out, there are groupings within the ANC who are saying, okay, she must also step aside. And this is a developing story, Bramaik. I will probably have more on this story as the week progresses.
Okay. And just very quickly before we round off, did you ever think that you would live to see the day a member of the Premier League is suspended from the ANC?
I doubt he thought he can ever be suspended himself. Superman Mopelo was very powerful in the Northwest during the time he was untouchable during the time when he was provincial chairman and premier. And I don't think he ever thought that it would happen to him, but it did happen. Now the ANC there, you know that we don't have a permanent ANC structure in the Northwest. So there's an interim structure, and it's the one that has taken the decision against Mahu Mapelo. If you remember, Pramaik, Super Mahu Mapelo was one of the leaders who came out in support of Ace Makashule last week when he seemed to be defying an NWC decision. Super Mahu Mapelo came out and said that Ace Makashule's interpretation of step aside is correct, which really is in defiance of what the ANC and national leaders have decided. But Super Mahu Mapelo is going to be key, Bramaik, in Ace Makashule's fight back campaign, because even though he may not be occupying any position of leadership in the ANC in the Northwest, he's still very influential. He still has relations with a lot of regional leaders and still loved by so many people on the ground, because as premier of the Northwest, he had control of resources and he was able to use those resources to gain some kind of popularity.
Okay, I think let's keep an eye on that, because we've just about run out of time. Let's keep an eye on the Super Mahu Mapelo story and see what happens to him, together with, and then maybe we catch up with it when we talk next time.
We'll do so, Bramaik. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay, thanks. That's where we leave it for this week, folks, on the Sunday Times Politics Weekly. And I'd like to thank my guests, political journalist Mawande Amashabalala, together with Sibonganonke Shoba, who is, of course, the Sunday Times Politics editor. And by the way, you can catch our podcast on Iona FM, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, stay safe, sanitize, wear the mask, and avoid crowded places. I'm Mike Siluma. Till next time.